Hello, Hot Flash fans. Big news. We've taken the heat to YouTube. Join us at Hello, Hot Flash podcast for empowering conversations, laughs, and a community that's as vibrant as you are. Subscribe, comment, and let's redefine midlife together. Hello, Hot Flash podcast, where we help you control the midlife change. Again, head over to YouTube and search for Hello, Hot Flash podcast. See you there. Hey there, I'm Stephanie Shaw. Welcome to the Hello Hot Flash podcast, where midlife women can learn from guest experts and authors who discuss menopause and all that comes with this new chapter in our lives. Hello Hot Flash, where we learn to control the change and not let the change control us. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Hello Hot Flash, where we help you control the midlife change. I'm excited to be here with my guest today, Dr. Doug Lucas. Dr. Doug is a dual board certified physician and orthopedic surgeon who left the traditional medical model to serve his mission of practicing medicine the way it should be practiced. Now, that's what intrigued me right there. Mm-hmm. First of all, welcome to the show. Again, I appreciate you being here with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I love doing this.
Yeah. So tell me, why did you leave the traditional medical model of practicing medicine?
Yeah. Well, I think you and most people know the answer to that, which is the model, you know, it has been developed the way it's been developed. And there's a lot of different theories on why it is as bad as it is in some ways. But it's really been developed to chase disease, which made sense back in the, you know, the turn of the century. We were really dealing mostly with chasing infections. And there was not a lot of things that we could do. Now we can do so many amazing things. The traditional medical model has a lot of really cool tools, great therapies, and wonderful doctors. So I never want to disparage the system. But for me, what I found as an orthopedic surgeon, especially trained in foot and ankle as my subspecialty, I really felt like I was just chasing disease. I was helping people with diabetes from a surgical perspective, which is not really what I felt like they needed. I loved talking to people about nutrition, about lifestyle, about prevention. And while we were doing a lot of good in the operating room, I wanted to talk about the other things, right? How do I keep you out of my operating room? And so eventually, after about 7 years of practice, that just came to a head and lifestyle got in the way and, you know, family issues. And we said, look, let's just try this. Let's see if we can make this fly. So I took a leap about a little over 3 years ago.
I love that. So I ran a nonprofit for a while and I said my whole goal is to work my way out of a job. So you worked your way out of one job, but then
into another.
Yeah, into another that can really help folks. I know that you have a focus that relates on women and hormones. Tell us why you're so focused on that area.
Yeah, it's so funny. It's something that I really never thought I would talk about in my practice, right? I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I'm a man. I wanted to just fix stuff with steel, you know? Right. And then as I got out of the orthopedic space, I started this practice called Optimal Human Health and very quickly realized that there was a role in there for managing bone health. And to manage both health optimization and bone health in particular, osteoporosis being that specific diagnosis, hormones are a big part of that. Mm-hmm. And so I already was trained in it. I did a fellowship in hormone and anti-aging. And so I had that background. And then we just really went headlong into it because there is an entire, really what I would look at like three generations of women that are being mismanaged from a hormone perspective, as far as I can tell. And I've had numerous conversations with OBGYN endocrinologists. And there is the traditional perspective on hormones. And then there are those of us that are up to date on the research that understand that so many women could be utilizing hormones that aren't, and that the risk-benefit equation that doctors like to talk about when they talk about hormone replacement or hormone optimization, they're not talking about it from an educated perspective because they don't really understand the risks. They understand the risks as they thought they did in the early 2000s, and that dogma has persisted. And so there's so many women that are missing out on the potential opportunity to use hormone therapy just because of there is this old dogma around risk that really shouldn't be there anymore.
So that's interesting. So as a woman, I went through all of the perimenopausal symptoms. I had like a list of 40 and didn't even know that that was my struggle. So talk to us a little bit about some of the common symptoms and when that light bulb should go off in your head and you need to start talking to your doctor.
Yeah, I'm writing a book on this right now. And so I've spent a lot of time looking into the research on this. And it's this really fascinating thing where when you say menopausal symptoms, mm-hmm. most women think hot flashes, night sweats, right? Like that's it.
Yeah.
And they are significant for a lot of women. They can be debilitating, right? But when you look at a list of symptoms of menopause, and some lists will have, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 different things, they're kind of divided into a couple of different groups. So there are the vasomotor symptoms. So that's hot flashes, night sweats. But then there are the, of course, they're always listed as like, quote unquote, psychiatric, right? I'm like, I hate that term. But there are things that fall under that list because they're like anxiety, brain fog, depression, worsening bipolar for people that suffer with that. So there is a change in mental function. There's a change in some of the balance between neurotransmitters that can occur. So that anxiety is really, really common, I see, in my patients. And most women don't think about that. They're like, gosh, why am I so anxious? Well, it's actually a symptom of losing your sex hormones. And then there's changes in body composition. So muscle mass loss, body composition changes. So your fat, which for a lot of women is, you know, in their thighs and butt, is going to move into their abdomen. And that's that shift in hormones, again, causing that change. The loss of muscle mass could then have an impact on glucose metabolism, insulin resistance. And then there's fatigue, there's sleep deprivation, because sleep, not even just from night sweats, but for other reasons, progesterone deficiency, sleep quality goes down. And then there's urogenital symptoms. So there's like, you know, vaginal dryness and chronic UTIs, et cetera. The list just goes on and on and on and on and on. And what's amazing, well, actually, I forgot a big bucket. Because the reason why why I was going to say this is amazing is when you look at men and aging, uh-huh. and you look at women as they go through menopause, the list is very, very similar with some obvious differences. But the area that I didn't talk about was sexual dysfunction. Mm-hmm. So this is something that happens in a lot of women really early, sort of in the early perimenopause, you know, mid-30s into 40s. And then it starts to get worse and worse and worse. And that's what I'm actually writing this book about, is testosterone deficiency is a big part of that. Not all postmenopausal women have testosterone deficiency, but many, many do. And when you look at the symptoms again of men versus women, men, we look at all these things and say, oh, it's part of aging. And we know that they get better with testosterone. And women, we say, well, most of those are irrelevant. It's just part of aging. And we're going to treat you with estrogen for your vasomotor symptoms. And that's it. And it is the disparity between the two is mind-blowing for me, and I could talk about it forever. The reason for it goes back many, many years, like hundreds of years.
So while we're there, I was going to start to talk a little bit about genetics and so forth, but while we're on testosterone, let's stay there for a little while. There could be a perceived fear around testosterone because there's an assumption that only men need testosterone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk to us about the role that testosterone plays in the woman's body, why we shouldn't be afraid of it, and why we need it.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think you might know the punchline here, but if you don't, this is going to blow your socks off, which is when I learned this, and this honestly wasn't even that long ago. I didn't learn this in my fellowship talking about hormones. It's just something that a lot of providers don't know. But when you look at a blood test for testosterone and estrogen and progesterone, which all of us in the hormone space should be doing, mm-hmm. estrogen always looks high, assuming that women have estrogen still. You know, you're looking at numbers in the high double digits to triple digits, right? That's a normal estrogen level, and it bounces up and down. Testosterone for women is going to be in the low double digits, potentially even single digits if they have low levels. And so it just makes sense. You say, oh, well, you know, women, the primary sex hormone is estrogen, and we really just need to focus on the estrogen. Yeah. But when you look closely at that lab report, you see that they're reported in different units. When you adjust for units, women have 5 to 10 times more testosterone than estrogen at any point in her life.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So when the first time I did that, I did the math and I was like, that can't be right. That can't be true. And it's true.
It's true.
So I found some papers that supported that. And there's some cool graphs out there that I show in talks, but it's true. So women will have more testosterone than estrogen by volume at any point in their life. So then what is mind blowing then is when we start looking at deficiencies of sex hormones and symptoms of aging and menopause and perimenopause, we almost never think about testosterone for women because it's a minor hormone, but it's not. It is a major hormone. And when you look at that list, all those things that I mentioned, yes, some of them are related to estrogen and get better with estrogen replacement, but most of them don't. And the ones that don't generally do get better with testosterone. And the literature supports that.
So I know that it's difficult for women to get testosterone. Is it illegal in some places?
Not illegal.
It's not illegal, but there's some difficulty in getting it. So if there is a deficiency, what is the conversation we're having with our doctor, and how can our doctor support us, or how should they be supporting us?
Ooh, those are two very different questions. So let's start with the first part, which is it hard to get? The answer is absolutely it's hard to get. The reason why it's hard to get is because there's no commercial product. So even if you had a doctor that knew what I just said about testosterone, how do they prescribe it? They have to use a compounding pharmacy, and the FDA hates compounding pharmacies with a passion. They don't want pharmacists in the compounding pharmacies to be able to recreate drugs, basically, because it interferes with the massive money machine that is the pharmaceutical industry. Mm-hmm. There are some safety concerns around compounding pharmacies, so that oversight is legitimate. And also, they shouldn't be impinging on patents. So there's a thing too. Right. But for things that are not available or in formulations that people need because they have intolerances to the way that traditional drugs are made, like, you know, peanut allergies and allergy to whatever's in some of these drugs, compounding pharmacies are critical. And it's the only way to get testosterone. So when we order it through compounding pharmacies. But it can't be run through insurance. There's no commercial product. So most doctors are afraid or unwilling to do that. An additional layer on that is that it is listed as a controlled substance. So it is listed as a level 3 controlled substance, which is the same as benzodiazepines, narcotics, right? Like all the things that doctors are afraid to prescribe inappropriately, which is good. But at the same time, there's a lot of oversight. So there's people looking over our shoulders. So anytime where I'm prescribing a large amount of a controlled substance, then people are looking over my shoulder. You have to have a controlled substance license to prescribe in any state. And like me, I'm licensed in all 50 states, or I'm about to be. And that there are about half of those states have additional controlled substance licenses. So it is very expensive to be able to prescribe a controlled substance like that.
Have you seen that women who take testosterone at the level that they need to take it, what type of improvements in their overall lifestyle, health, well-being are you seeing?
Yeah. So the kind where people log onto a Zoom meeting like this and they're jumping up and down and they're sending me cards. And so the things that are most profound for women that have sexual dysfunction from testosterone deficiency, where, you know, they have truly, you know, intimacy issues and they've lost their intimacy with their partner and there are challenges with that. I mean, when they get that back, it's a game changer, mm-hmm. right? Like all of a sudden your relationship with your partner is so much better. That's a big deal. Yeah. Plus, they're thinking better. They have more energy. They have more vitality. They want to go lift weights. They want to go participate in social things. They want to go do stuff with their kids. Like all the stuff you hear about with men with testosterone, it's all true for women too. And so, you know, their body composition starts to change. They develop more muscle mass. They feel stronger. They look better in their clothes. They're like, doctor, where has this been all my life? You know? And so we do see these really, really big changes, and it's all of it. You know, it's not just testosterone, like it's not a panacea, but it helps you to do the lifestyle things. And then if you have the capacity to combine it then with estrogen and progesterone, then you can really hit all the triggers and you can make a lot of things better.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I struggle with the idea around, like, it feels like more women are struggling with menopause. I don't know if that it's because we're now feel more free to have these types of conversations because there's podcasts and information mm-hmm. like this. I don't know if our ancestors just did not struggle with menopause in the same manner that we did, or they didn't know what was going on. So why is this so common now? Why are we seeing, you know, 100 symptoms of perimenopause out?
Yeah. So I have a couple of theories on that. I think you're right that the conversation is open, right? Like, somehow the door got busted open off of the box that contained women and symptoms, right? Like, it's okay to talk about your symptoms. Please do. Yeah. And that hasn't been true. I mean, for the longest time, right? I mean, again, for centuries, women have been sort of shoved into this box to say, like, look, this doesn't matter. This is part of aging. Go away. Stop talking. Yeah. So now women are talking about it, and it's important because the conversation's out there. How are you really feeling? How is your life actually affected by these changes that start, again, mid-30s for a lot of women, we see these changes. And then I think that there's two other big components of this. So one is also the social stresses put on women. You know, women, I find so many of my patients, they have a full-time job, they are caregivers for children, and now at this age, also potentially parents, right? And that is all put on women in many households. And a lot of the men are sort of still in this paradigm of like, well, I'm the breadwinner, I'm gonna go to work and all this stuff is my wife's fault, but I also want her to have a full-time job, right? It's like, wait, It doesn't work both ways.
Hold on.
And so there's a lot of additional stress. And so I think the impact of that, though, is that women have the capacity to make both progesterone and testosterone through their adrenal glands. So it's not all ovarian. When the ovaries start to fail, as women go get deeper into perimenopause and into menopause, as the ovaries start to fail, they will lose estrogen because that's where almost all the estrogen is made. So that's out. But if you have good functioning adrenal glands, like our ancestors did, right? Because they weren't stressed out. They were getting 10 hours of sleep a night and they ate, you know, adequate food. When your adrenal glands still work, you still have testosterone. Mm-hmm. So again, 80% of those symptoms from the list of menopause, they're not there yet, right? So they still had testosterone. They actually still made progesterone too. And so I think that we are seeing worse symptoms now because it's not just an estrogen deficiency. Now it's an all three deficiency. It's dramatic. You know, and then take into account, of course, the social pressure of being super lean and not eating enough food and eating highly processed food and then all the other garbage stuff that goes along with it. And you got just an absolute disaster.
Do you prescribe to genetics? So like if my mom had bad menopause symptoms, I'm going to have them too. Or do you think that it could be your genes, but then you activate those genes?
I think there's both, right? Like, I think that I like to look at it like this way. You've probably heard this described this way, which is genes will load the gun, but you got to pull the trigger.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So you know that you have the risk based off of family history, or if you're testing genetics, and we do test a lot of genetics. So that's part of our program, but epigenetics plays a huge role. And so that is which of those genes are actually being utilized. What are the proteins that are being made? And that's driven by lifestyle. And so I think that, yeah, genetics is part of it. But the epigenetics, the lifestyle, the things that that we have control over is much, much more powerful.
Talk to us a little bit about some additional misconceptions related to optimizing women's hormones.
Oh man, where to start? I think probably the biggest thing to get out of people's heads is the fear and the danger associated with hormones. Just see this all the time. And again, I said, there's really three generations of women, and it's the women that are now, you know, 70 to 50, that time frame, where those are the women that they went through menopause right when the Women's Health Initiative, very famous study, came out and showed that estrogen was potentially associated with an increased risk of breast cancer. The majority of that population of that generation was not offered hormone therapy because there was so much fear. And then there is the generation younger than that, which is now they're having issues, but that fear is still there. And a lot of the practitioners aren't willing to prescribe it. Mm-hmm. So this fear around breast cancer and estrogen is really based off of several studies, but people talk about the Women's Health Initiative all the time, health initiative. And so let me just like take 2 minutes and describe this. It'll blow your mind. So you go back and look at that original study from 2001. You go back and look at that original study, it was the Women's Health Initiative was a massive trial. It was a randomized controlled trial, well-funded, and I forget the total number of people, but it was over 100,000 women. And they were divided into, from a hormone side, they were divided into two groups. One group had estrogen and a synthetic progesterone called a progestin. The other group was estrogen alone for women that had a hysterectomy. And these were both synthetic. It was an oral estrogen, so there's issues with that out of the gate. But that was the standard therapy at the time. So then they stopped after about 5 years, and then they published on the data. They stopped the study because they were concerned about an increased risk of breast cancer. And that's a reasonable thing to do. If you're seeing a trend, okay, look, this is a big deal. We should probably stop the study. But it's the way that they wrote the report that was so damning to hormones. So they said, and you can read this very clearly, go on PubMed, look it up online. They basically said that they stopped it because of an increased risk of breast cancer. But when you look at the statistics, it did not reach statistical significance. It was a trend. It was close, but it wasn't quite there. And in a study that large, if it's not reaching statistical significance, it may not be clinically significant. In fact, it's likely not clinically significant, right? What they also didn't really talk about is that there was a reduced risk of colon cancer, a massive reduction in fracture risk from osteoporosis. And then really the study was all about heart health to begin with. And there was a concern that maybe there was some issue with stroke because that was a signal as well. And that was likely because of the oral estrogen component or the synthetic progesterone. But anyway, they stopped it. But the other arm, the estrogen only arm, continued on for another 2 years. So then they published those data. When they published those data, they didn't really talk about this much in the results. They talked about the reduction in colon cancer, the reduction in fracture risk. Those things were still true. But it looked like, oddly, that the estrogen was protective of breast cancer. How could that be? I think it's a stroke of irony or divine comedy. I don't know. But statistically, to a thousandth of a point, the estrogen-only group was as protective of breast cancer as the estrogen and synthetic progesterone, the progesterone group, was potentially at risk of breast cancer, right? In the opposite direction.
Right.
And yet the takeaway from those studies was estrogen causes breast cancer.
Right.
Why? It's not the estrogen. It was the synthetic progesterone, likely. And when you fast forward 20 years and you look at now other studies, we see that those progestins do in fact increase your risk of breast cancer. Oral estrogens will increase your risk of blood clot. So you can actually make sense of all of the risks, the signal that was shown in the Women's Health Initiative, by substituting topical for oral estrogen and using real progesterone rather than the synthetic progestins. It all goes away. And yet, decades now of damage done to hundreds of millions of women across the world.
Yeah, we're still talking about it. I was actually at an event this week and with a gynecologist, and she's still on the opposite side of, you know, HRT is bad and it's causing cancer in everyone. And I'm like, oh, was not the place to have a conversation. Right.
It's hard to argue.
Yeah, it is hard to argue. And I understand that everyone needs to make a decision for themselves.
Right.
Also recognizing that when you get to that place in your body where you cannot function and you need additional support, there are things that can support you. And HRT right. is one of those.
Well, and it's, like I said in the beginning, it's a risk-benefit equation. Mm-hmm. But you have to understand the risk to understand how to do that. And I will say this too. I don't want to say that estrogen isn't associated with cancer at all.
Right.
If you have an estrogen positive breast cancer, because again, statistically, the risk of developing breast cancer as a woman is 1 in 7. Mm-hmm. So it's a high, right? So if you develop breast cancer and you are on estrogen, it will grow faster if it's estrogen sensitive, right? So it's not without risk. But to say that estrogen causes breast cancer, I think is an overstatement of the data. I think we have plenty of data to say the opposite. In fact, estrogen may be protective of breast cancer. So may be testosterone. It actually causes cancer cells to go pop and go through apoptosis. So again, I think if you can recreate the symphony of hormones, progesterone, testosterone, estrogen, you are likely going to end up protecting a woman from breast cancer. But there's not enough data to say that that's actually true.
I'm team lifestyle change. So I always say that. But again, it for me, it totally worked, that complete lifestyle change. But I understand that for some women, it does not. And I don't want that fear to be there because of.
Yeah. And I think, you know, go back to your question about ancestrally, you know, how do women get through it? Well, again, they still had natural progesterone and testosterone circulating. So if you can optimize your lifestyle, optimize your adrenal function, then you are going to feel better. You can make a lot of those things better.
Yeah.
To say that you're going to, because I hear this a lot on social media and YouTube channels, you know, you're going to balance your estrogen in the postmenopausal state. No, you're not. You don't have any. There's nothing to balance, right? But that might be okay. But then I run into this other issue because I have this bone health population. Half of our practice are people with osteoporosis. And some women, they didn't have any symptoms in menopause, right? So they went through it. They didn't have symptoms. They felt great. They didn't go on hormone replacement, but now they have osteoporosis. Mm. And osteoporosis is strongly associated with estrogen deficiency. Adding estrogen back, adding testosterone, even though they're only estrogens FDA approved for osteoporosis, but adding them both back as well as progesterone, that symphony together will impact bones in multiple different ways. So then the question is, well, actually they probably, depending on their starting point, wouldn't have developed osteoporosis if they had had estrogen replacement. So again, like, how do you understand the risk? You don't have a crystal ball to look forward, but I have a lot of women that are frustrated that like, oh, I should have gone on this. I was thinking about it. I didn't do it because I was concerned about the risk, which was overstated.
I think the answer to my question is what you already just said, that you don't have a crystal ball, but I'm thinking about women who may be feeling great in this stage of life. They're still concerned about osteoporosis. Like, again, it's just that risk factor is what I'm hearing. Like,
and that's the most clear one. There's also evidence to support the idea that maintaining estrogen, especially in those first 10 years, will reduce your risk of dementia. But then there's also evidence to say that it could go the other way. So yeah. It kind of depends on which side of the fence you're on. I think from a testosterone perspective, the muscle mass is a big one, because we know that women will predictably lose muscle mass and go through those body composition changes. It's a challenging thing, but I think having that conversation with somebody who does prescribe, who has the knowledge base to understand, you know, potentially what the risk is, that's the way to have that conversation. Versus, unfortunately, OBGYNs are tasked with the idea that they have to take care of women's hormones, but they're not well trained in it. You know, and there are OBGYNs that are out there on social media and YouTube now that are very, very vocal about this, to say, look, I had almost no training in postmenopausal care. I had almost no training in hormone replacement, right? Just the pharmaceutical industry saying either birth control or, you know, the Lavelle dot and you're good. Yeah. That's all you need to know. We've done all the research. You don't need to measure labs. Just we're good. And that's just not true.
Yeah. And I'm hearing that so much now that it just like freaks me out. But that's a conversation for another day. Next question. What are three simple changes someone can make today to help improve their hormone health?
Well, it depends on their starting point. So give me just a little bit more. Who am I talking to?
Let's talk to me. So I'm feeling great. A ton of different lifestyle changes. I only have a hot flash if I'm drinking kombucha or eating a lot of tropical fruit. So I know what my triggers are.
That's funny.
Yeah,
that's funny.
How am I going to get to that next level and or stabilize where I'm at?
Yeah. So I think I'll point the lifestyle at the outcome that I'm looking for. And so I think the two biggest areas where women really struggle in this state outside of, you know, just hormone replacement, right. But you know, with or without would be adrenal health. So the biggest thing from an adrenal health perspective is controlling stress. So finding some way to mitigate stress, understanding what, you know, how much stress you're under, what to do about it. And if you need tools like journaling, mindfulness, meditation, you know, whatever it is, whatever is good for you. Then to do that and make time for that. So I think that's probably number one. These are in no particular order. Number two, which is probably the most important, would actually be getting adequate sleep. This is not specifically a woman thing. Men do this too. But I really see it in women. And in the postmenopausal state, when anxiety starts to really build, sleep goes down. Progesterone also deficiency is an issue here. But anxiety, progesterone deficiency, all the stresses that come along with being a woman in this age range causes sleep to just go in the toilet. So optimizing sleep, making sure you're prioritizing sleep, having great sleep hygiene, all those things. And then the third biggest thing that I see is chronic dieting, calorie deficiency, protein deficiency, call it whatever you want. You know, this idea that you have to, you know, continue to look the same way that you did when you were 20. And the way that you're going to do that is by exercising more and eating less. Like, that is not the answer. And so we generally go through this sort of like reframing kind of mindset work to say, look, you need adequate calories, focusing on protein. For most women, that means eating more. But we don't see, women aren't gaining weight when they work with us for the most part, right? They're changed body composition. Some will lose a little bit of weight. It's generally not our primary goal is weight loss, but we want to optimize your health, optimize your gut. And that comes from eating an adequate and well-balanced diet.
I love that. Those are three wonderful suggestions. And I have two more questions for you.
Yeah.
What are you reading or listening to right now?
So I write this weekly kind of like update to my team. Some of the feedback I get is that I read and listen to a lot of books, which is true. Just I love learning and digesting information. So I will say the most impactful book I've read lately is probably this book I have sitting right beside me. So the book called Sex at Dawn by Christopher Ryan. So it's a really interesting book that actually is very well tied to this conversation around what has happened to women's health, specifically sexual health, over the last several kind of 100 years. They go back to the dawn part of this means like the beginning of time, you know, and what happened as we, whatever you want to call it, you know, transitioned into our current species, and what's happened as we enter the Industrial Revolution, and what's happened with the, you know, the gender gap and all these things. It is fascinating. And it helps explain, and I don't know how to put it in my book, but it helps explain why we don't, as a society, want to talk about women's sexual health after the age of like 18, right? Like we just ignore it as if it doesn't matter and doesn't exist. And so just super fascinating book.
Awesome. Love that. And how can folks find you?
Yeah. The easiest thing, if you want to have one place to go, is just go to drdouglucas.com, and that has the links to all the things. Most people find us on YouTube. It's called the Dr. Doug Show, as it is highlighted behind me. But the Dr. Doug Show, where we talk mostly about hormone health and bone health and women's health optimization from midlife and beyond, is how we say it.
Yeah. And you're launching a podcast soon as well, correct?
Yeah, so that has been kind of a mess, but we had two different YouTube channels, and one was a podcast and the other one wasn't. So basically what we did is just combined them both, squished them together. So now we have a podcast, we're sort of rebranding everything. So just look for the Dr. Doug Show. That'll be the lead of all of it.
All right, awesome. Once again, thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Doug.
Yeah, thank you. Great questions. This was fun.
Awesome. Thank you everyone for listening to Hello Hot Flash, where we help you control the midlife change. Make sure to check out the show notes, where we will include links to all of the subjects that we have covered today. Everyone, here's to your health.